Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. We are delighted to have you with us. Today, we are going to be looking back on the relationship between King Charles and Queen Camilla, because it is their 19th wedding anniversary on the 9th of April, which is a couple of days after we record and a couple of days before the episode comes out. So it's in that nice little sandwich period for people who are anxious about uneven numbers and are like, why didn't they wait until 20th? I also had that feeling of wanting to wait until their 20th wedding anniversary. But then Grace rightfully pointed out, anything can happen in a year, so it's better to do it now than to wait around and then not be able to do it next year for whatever reason.
Yeah, you never know. Maybe their 20th anniversary, we could do something else. But
yes. So we're going to start off, obviously, by giving you a little bit of background into who these people were. I don't think I need to say who King Charles was, because I think everybody knows. Camilla was born Camilla Shand in July 1947. She grew up between London and East Sussex with her parents, a retired army officer turned businessman Major Bruce Shand, and his wife, the Honourable Rosalind Cubitt, who was daughter of the third Baron Ashcombe. And she wasn't an aristocrat as such, because she wasn't titled, her father wasn't titled, but she came from a wealthy family with sort of good lineage. She'd been a debutante. She had been presented at the court. She was quite active on the London social scene. And you have people who knew Camilla before she met Charles, who have kind of, I looked at some of the descriptions of them, of her from when she was sort of in school and when she was sort of active on the London social scene when she was in her teens, and saw a lot of words like she was a tomboy, she was boisterous, she was a bit of a flirt. She was apparently fired from a secretarial job because she came in late after partying one night.
Yeah, she definitely gives off that kind of, if you were watching a period drama, she'd be like the cheeky American yes. cousin that come yes. in and be like, oh, why do the English always eat toast for breakfast? We do yeah. fun things. You know, that the kind of fun one in the corner.
Yes, the one with the sassy remark. But you know that it's kind of from a good place, so you're not angry at them.
So, Camilla, living her best life in the mid-1960s. As far as we know, and a lot of this next section will be as far as we know,
yes.
according to most of the reports, because there's a lot of discrepancies between yes. them. But as far as we know, it was in 1965, Camilla was introduced to a man called Andrew Parker Bowles, who was also on the scene as a handsome young polo player who knew the then Prince Charles and had played on the same polo team as him. And they kind of started a bit of an on-off flirty relationship. And they had lots of on periods and lots of off periods. Even though there are lots of sort of discrepancies about what happened throughout that relationship, one thing that is generally agreed upon is that during one of their off periods, Andrew and Camilla were both dating other people. And one of those people that Camilla dated was Charles. And there's been loads of rumours about when they met, where they met, who they met, what date. There are some saying they met in 1972, some saying they met in 1968, some saying it was in 1970, some saying it was at polo, some saying it wasn't at polo. The kind of, when I really sort of boiled down to it, it seems to me that they were introduced by a friend called Lucia Santa Cruz, who was the daughter, I think, of the Cuban ambassador. In 1970, which was just after Andrew Parker Bowles started dating another royal known as Princess Anne, the same year. So they were still very much in the same link. And there's lots of rumours that, you know, some of it was Camilla being furious that Andrew was dating a royal, so she was just going to give date one as well. And also lots of people saying that actually Charles and Camilla just met and quite liked each other.
Yes, I think famously immortalised by The Crown, they focused a lot of attention on this weird, it's not really a love triangle, it's not really a love square either. So I think in a love square you'd have to have like Charles would have to be in love with Anne or Paul Andrew, and he wasn't. So it's not really a full love square, but it was complicated. It was a shape that doesn't exist. It was so complicated.
So I was really enjoying this part of my research because there was this kind of weird love extravaganza pentagon thing happening. There's a lot of kind of they're in the same, they go to, they're all at the same polo matches. They're all, you know, popping up at the same events. You know, Charles plays polo, Andrew plays polo, Anne and Mark both ride horses, Camilla rides horses. They're all, you know, hanging out together all the time in some kind of weird, all godfathers to each other's children. And at that point, I was losing my mind a bit and had was like writing a world longest timeline I've ever seen.
We'll have to do a separate episode on the love square of or Andrew P Princess Anne's romances we could do.
Yeah, Princess Anne's romances. But it was just so fascinating to me. And this was at the point where I was just texting you, being like, why are they all dating each other? Why have they all got the same names? So annoying.
But no, I do think it's interesting because there's this famous anecdote that goes around that, again, we don't know if it's true. I don't even know where it came from originally. It's one of those things that's passed into myth because it's repeated so often. There's a famous anecdote that she introduced herself to Charles wherever they met, at a dinner or at polo in 1970 or 1971, or we know wherever you think it was, by telling him that her great grandmother had been the mistress of his great great grandfather. So why don't they get it on, essentially? Which, I mean, that would be an excellent chat up line.
Yeah, I respect that. I would definitely do that if I had that as an opportunity.
You know, we don't know whether that's actually true, but I think one of the reasons that that story has stuck is because of something that I think comes up throughout my notes and throughout my thoughts on this, is this sort of Camilla myth that she was this kind of sexually promiscuous woman who had this like intoxicating effect on men, that they were just uncontrollable around her because she was so sexy and perhaps she was, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But she is kind of singled out at a time when, even amongst the aristocracy and royalty, there was a lot more sexual freedom. And, you know, I think if you look at sort of in the 1960s, I think it would have been Lord Snowden, Princess Margaret's husband, was in the middle of a bisexual threesome. I think got what the female part of that threesome pregnant at one point. He was, and everybody in the royal family loved Lord Snowden. And then you also have, as we've mentioned, you have Anne, who was having a romantic relationship with Andrew Parker Bowles to get back at her previous boyfriend, Mark Phillips. And yet that's not been the narrative that has stuck with Anne, that she's kind of like loose and sexually promiscuous and going around, you know, until The Crown. I think a lot of people didn't even know that she'd had boyfriends before Mark. So I think it's just really interesting that, you know, even in the stories about how they met, the fixation on Camilla as being this like a slightly unusual person because she was sexy and you know, open and liked having fun. And it, you know, when you think about her childhood, like she was a voracious reader and she had a very stable family life, lots of really positive things that could have become the image of Camilla, but instead it's the fact that she was a tomboy and she was boisterous and she was outgoing and a bit flirtatious even at a young age. And so, you know, it kind of, I don't know, I just think you can see that, like, even in the early stages when we talk about their relationship, there's this Camilla myth that has taken hold.
I think Camilla Myth is a great ti episode title, which we can say.
The Camilla myth. Well, you don't think that Love Square is good?
Love's great.
Love Square's great.
Love, weird shape that doesn't exist. If, you know, other people had done it, it would be viewed as kind of like a funny joke. Like, oh, isn't she funny bringing that up on the first encounter?
There is a lot of debate about their relationship, and I think the most common story is that Charles was head over heels in love with Camilla and wanted to marry her, but the evil royals objected because Camilla was a brazen hussy. And so they all conspired together to have King Charles sent abroad with the navy. And then they forced Camilla and Andrew into getting engaged, very much like an upper class equivalent of what a shotgun wedding actually was. Like a shotgun wedding was, you would have a shotgun pointed at you. And it was very much like the upper class version of that, which was putting an announcement in the Times. It's a bit different, but to them, it has the same weight as a shotgun, probably. And that, you know, Charles was obviously devastated because Camilla was his one true love. But I think it's interesting to actually look at what did happen, what we know happened.
In December 1972, at this point, Charles wrote a letter to his uncle, Lord Mountbatten. And in that letter, he spoke about how sad it was that the love of his life, his relationship with the woman he was in love with, was over, essentially. Mm-hmm. So he's still in England at this point. He's not yet left the country. In February 1973, Charles goes off to sea. So at least 2 months after they've split up to the point where he's writing sad letters to his uncle about it. March, so a month after Charles went to sea, Camilla got engaged to Andrew Parker Bowles. And obviously the rumour is that Andrew didn't actually propose until after his father and Camilla's father put the announcement in the newspaper that they were getting married.
I love that. I hope that's true.
Which I just like to think they sat down together, right, these two are never going to get married on their own. We're just going to have to shove them into it.
Yeah.
So they put it in the paper. They got married in a Catholic ceremony on July the 4th. So, yeah. I mean, within those, 3 years, they did quite a bit of getting together, but the timeline does not actually match up with the story that they sent Charles to sea, and as a result of that, they broke up, and then they got tricked into getting together and getting married.
We don't actually know a lot of whether these stories are true or not, but there's no evidence that like this was some sort of evil royal plot. There are letters that Charles had written to Mountbatten after they broke up, where he said, "I suppose this feeling of emptiness will pass eventually," which obviously does make it seem like, yes, Charles was indeed head over heels in love with Camilla, and perhaps he was. But I have also felt that way over Domino's delivery men when they stopped delivering to me. So I don't know.
Yeah, I get that. I think Charles is a very dramatic person. He likes poetry and painting. Like, he will be writing that over. He's the type of person that over a paper cup would be like, one day this agony will end.
he's Thomas from Ghosts.
He is. Exactly who he is.
If you haven't seen Ghosts, you should go and watch it. It's great. But I think the most important quote that I read about this was from John Bowes-Lyon, who was a cousin of Andrew Parker Bowles, and also, because of the Bowes-Lyon family, was related to the Queen Mother somehow. I don't know exactly how, so would have been related to Charles. And what he said was, Camilla was very much in love with Andrew. And perhaps Charles did fall deeply in love with Camilla, but Camilla loved Andrew more. That's what it seems like to me. Yeah. I'm not aware that Charles ever approached the Queen to ask for permission to propose to Camilla. And on Camilla's side of things, it seems like it was quite clear that she never really wanted to marry Charles at the time. The likelihood is they'd already broken up because it was a fling for Camilla and she wanted to marry somebody else. And Charles was just a little bit upset about it because he's overly dramatic.
So Charles is still not married. Footloose and Fancy Free in the late 1970s, which is around the same time that Camilla and Andrew start to have some relationship troubles because Andrew is having some flings on the side, and Charles and Camilla start chatting again, and they really start chatting again in 1979 when Lord Mountbatten, the one who's been receiving all these sad letters from Charles, was killed in a terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. So Andrew knows what's going on. He's also having affairs. Mm-hmm. Charles at this point is still single. He's not dating anyone. And it's like an open secret within the upper classes. Everyone knows that Charles and Camilla are having a little thing, and Andrew and Camilla are practically dating other people at this point.
I think one of the things I found interesting was all of the articles talking about how irresistible he was to women. And I'm like, I've seen pictures of Andrew Parker Bowles, and I do not understand how he is irresistible to anyone. I don't mean to, that sounds really, really horrible, but you know, I'm a solid five. It takes one to know one.
He looked like even when he was young, like 20s, 30s, he looked like he was about 70. Mm. Just his face structure was like an old man.
Like an old baby.
An old baby. That's exactly it.
Yeah. For all of their prudishness, the British aristocracy really pioneered the concept of open marriages.
They really did.
Yeah, because they were all hanging, like, there were photographs as well of them, like, all hanging out as a group. Like, they'd all go to polo together, and it would be, like, Charles and Andrew and Camilla, and it all seemed to be absolutely fine. Like, there's even people and stories and articles and things that have said that Andrew Parker Bowles was really flattered that his wife was sleeping with the future king.
Well, I mean, if you're going to be cheated on by one person, you might as well just go straight for the future king.
Yeah, he found it like a badge of honour.
Anyway, in this period of time, the late 1970s, you know, like I said, Diana's not in the picture. That does change in 1980. And they both happened, Charles and Diana both happened to be staying at a friend's house, Philip de Passe. And she said that they were having a chat about Lord Mountbatten and Charles got really emotional and then jumped on her. And apparently that's how their relationship started. And 1980 is when that like one picture of Camilla and Diana walking together at the polo was taken. And then in September 1980, Diana is spotted at Balmoral. Camilla's also at Balmoral. And then in 1981, Charles and Diana announced their engagement. And as far as we know, from everyone involved, that was also the end of, you know, the Charles and Camilla affair part one.
The next big dispute after the first dispute of when they got actually met each other is kind of when did their relationship resume? But the most common date that is given and the one that seems to be the most reliable is that the affair resumed in 1986. So they got married in 1981, Diana and Charles, and the affair with Camilla and Charles resumed in 1986. And this is something that was stated in Andrew Morton's book, I believe, which is, was written, we now know was written, but basically by Diana. Charles said that the affair started in 1986. And I think very crucially in the Panorama interview that Diana gave, the date 1986 was mentioned and she didn't dispute that. And she said a lot of things in that interview. So if it had been wrong, if they'd been having an affair the entire time, she would have said, actually, no. She talked about how she realised that he was having an affair because she'd noticed a change in Charles's behaviour. And so that would suggest that there was a period of about 5 years at the beginning of the marriage of Charles and Diana where he was not in a relationship with Camilla. They were still friends. They still all hung out together in this weird little arrangement that they all had. But there was no, you know, as we've seen, the aristocracy seems to have very different attitudes towards relationships and things because it's such a small circle. If you cut off everyone you ever dated or had any kind of romantic allegiance with, you would have no friends left. And so, yeah, they were all part of the same sort of social circle and things, but there's no evidence to suggest that they were anything more than sort of very close friends who had this history together.
You know, Charles and Camilla at this point had known each other for about 10 years. They were closer in age than Charles and Diana. So there were going to be things. They have this whole history together that they would talk about that you wouldn't talk about with anyone else.
Yeah.
And it was just a friendship for 5 years. It was just friends.
So the War of the Whales is the fight between Diana and Charles, and that is a separate episode. I am resisting the urge to analyse all of that. The one person who we know would have said, if their relationship had continued and a sort of they'd had been having an affair the whole time, is Diana, and she had plenty of opportunities and she never said that. She might have suggested that they were still sort of emotionally connected to one another in a way that made her feel uncomfortable, which, as I say, I'm not going to get into whether she was right or wrong in that, but she would have said if they had never stopped having an affair the whole time, and she didn't. So I think we can assume that the 1986 date is pretty reliable. Yeah, so the general consensus is that they began their relationship again at some point in 1986. And I looked back at a lot of articles from this time period, and the press started to talk really about the tension between Charles and Diana and the fact that their marriage wasn't very good from sort of 1987. And there were lots of things about affairs or quote unquote close friendships. When you look at these articles, Camilla's almost never mentioned. I only really saw a couple of articles where Camilla was mentioned, but it was always in the context of like people have commented on the close friendship between Charles and Camilla. But when they were at this thing together, her husband Andrew was there. And so there was it was almost like her having this marriage with Andrew was like a shield.
Yeah, like she's just happily being at home being cheated on. It's fine, guys.
Yeah, it's absolutely fine. Yeah. They were not really fixated on Camilla at all. Until June of 1992, when Andrew Morton published his book, which we later found out was written very, very heavily based on Diana's own account of her relationship and her marriage. At the time, we didn't know that necessarily. It was just believed to be sort of a book that was, you know, had good sources or whatever. But it was this book really that pushed Camilla's name to the front of like, she is the main one.
Yeah, the press just didn't really consider her. And then Diana was like, look, you've got this all wrong, guys. There is a one person to look at here.
Yeah, exactly. But I think because you have to remember at the time, they didn't know that Diana had had any collaboration with the book. Even her, some of her closest friends didn't necessarily know that she'd collaborated on this book. I remember reading about like the palace was desperately hunting for the mole of like who had been releasing information from the palace, and not knowing it was Diana herself. But yeah, so at the time it was, you know, there's been lots of salacious books in recent years over here that have said things about the current royal family, but everybody sort of takes things with a pinch of salt because a lot of the time the sources don't go down record, or they don't want to be named, or you don't know how realistic or accurate the book is. So you kind of have to take things with a bit of caution. And that was kind of the attitude at the time. Like, it was explosive, but there was no reason to believe that it was any more true than anything else that had been written about them. So I think their relationship, like Camilla and Charles's relationship on like a day-to-day basis, didn't necessarily change.
Yeah, you've got to like compare it to, you know, if we think about recent books that have come out, they kind of have like a very short shelf life, apart from Spare, because we know it was written by Harry.
Yeah.
Like, we know who wrote that. It's him, the man involved.
Yeah. After the book had come out, in the December of 1992, it was announced that Charles and Diana had officially separated. But crucially, Camilla and Andrew were still together. It seemed clear that like Charles wasn't leaving Diana for Camilla, because as far as anybody knew, Camilla and Andrew were still happily together.
When Charles and Diana's separation was announced, it was announced along with the fact that they're not actually looking to divorce right now. It was more of a, they're not together, but they're still a family, kind of. Even then, you know, it was a separation, not a divorce. And I think that particularly in the 90s and within a Church of England family is important, because it's different than a divorce. And a separation is, there's a possibility of reunion.
Yes.
You know, it's not final.
Yeah. So at this point in time, sort of December 1992, Charles and Diana had separated. So obviously their marriage wasn't going great. But as far as we knew, Camilla and Andrew's relationship was fine. And there wasn't 100% confirmation that Charles and Camilla had actually been having an affair, or that it was still ongoing, or, you know, anything like that. And then in January of 1993, we had the bombshell that kind of confirmed everything to a degree, of the infamous tampon gate tapes, or the Camilla gate tapes. And you can see episode 66, where we talk about phone hacking, and we talk about the tampon gates in tapes in that context, if you want to find out a little bit more. But essentially, for those who don't know, this was a tape recording of a conversation that had been intercepted between Charles and Camilla that happened in 1989. Obviously, the thing that everybody fixates on is that they have a conversation about how Charles wants to live inside Camilla's trousers, and they have a joke about like, oh, knowing his luck, he'd come back as a tampon. I think that all sort of sexy talk is cringy if you're not one of the participants and you're not in a sexy mood.
Yes, agreed.
Yes. So I think like it is cringy, absolutely, but it would be cringy if it was about anybody. It's just the nature of that kind of communication. If you exclude that part of the call and the sort of sexy parts of the call, they have this really lovely conversation about kind of trying to get to see each other, and about how he's worried about this speech that he's got to give. And like, she, without prompting, she says, oh, can I see a copy of the speech that you've just done? There's a bit towards the end where he's sort of yawning, and she's sort of like, you know, you've got to get some sleep, because we all know that Charles stays up till like 3 a.m. writing letters and doing work and all these sort of, you know, all of the members of the family have talked about that. And so, you know, it was sort of this sort of very caring, almost maternal kind of, you know, no, you've got to go and get some sleep. I know that you want to stay up and talk to me, but you've got... So beyond, I think the people fixate on the parts of the call that lend themselves to this narrative, this Camilla myth that I mentioned earlier, of this idea that she was some sort of hussy, and that their relationship was entirely sort of sexual, and that's what she used her sexuality to intoxicate and snare Charles away from the perfect Diana. And actually, I'm not going to talk about the sort of the morality of the fact that they were having an affair. That's, I'll talk about that later. But if we just the content of the call, there was actually a lot in there that was very sweet and gentle and loving. And so it doesn't seem entirely fair what people take away from those calls.
Yeah, like if you remove the sexy bits,
yeah,
you could easily just say that's just two really good friends, which
yeah.
I think,
yeah,
you know, at their heart, even now, is what Charles and Camilla are. They're best friends because they were such good friends. They just kind of chose each other to talk to over anyone else. And I think you know, we know from at this point, Charles and Diana, you know, in 1989, were having marital difficulties. They probably weren't having late night chat, loving chats, led in bed together, being like, oh, I've had a stressful day, Diana. She got me too. They probably weren't doing that. So he had to talk to someone, and he chose his good friend and love interest, Camilla.
But obviously this tape came out and kind of, I guess, confirmed that at least in 1989, they had been in a relationship, and that what the Andrew Morton book said was true. You know, Camilla was the other woman narrative that was very much taking off. All at the same time as Camilla was dealing with her mother's slow, agonizing death from osteoporosis. She died in 1994, which I think does sort of highlight the inequality that's kind of always followed Camilla and her story. Because at this point in time, people started portraying Andrew Parker Bowles as like a cuckold. Like he was, you know, he'd had to witness his wife have an affair with somebody else, and what a wronged party he was. It was like he was sleeping with everyone.
Yeah, like Camilla, as far as we know, had one affair. Andrew had about 14 everyone.
Yeah. So it was just, I don't know. There's just this narrative that had already started to build that, like, you know, Camilla was the only one in this situation who was actually doing anything wrong.
In 1994, Charles decided it would be a really good idea. And I'm just going to say, maybe members of the royal family should stop doing interviews.
Yeah.
Because Charles thought it'd be a lovely idea if he got together with David Dimbleby. No, wrong one. Jonathan Dimbleby.
Yeah. Too many Dimbleby.
too many Dimbleby's. With Jonathan Dimbleby, who is a very sort of good, famous, traditional news bulletin journalist, reporter man.
That's his full title.
And had a little interview with him to kind of set the record straight. I did, in fact, have an affair with someone called Camilla, who's my best friend. We've been having an affair since 1986. At this point, the first person who officially said that, yep, there's been an affair was Charles. And like all good royal interviews, it came with a whole load of backlash and bad PR for them all.
It wasn't just like, it wasn't like Panorama, where he did like a sit-down interview where he just talked about his marriage. Like, it was all about sort of his work and all that kind of stuff as well. But the only bit anybody ever remembers, of course, is the bit where he confirmed. And he confirmed the sort of 1986 thing. And he said that they'd only started the relationship when his marriage to Diana had irretrievably broken down, us both having tried, I think was, I did that off the top of my head, yes. But I think that was the language he used.
A verbatim quote there.
Yeah, that was good. Clearly I've read that too many times during my research. But it is believed that was sort of the catalyst that led to Camilla and Andrew having a divorce. They announced that they were getting divorced in January of 1995, and a lot of people state that the Charles kind of going on the record and saying, yes, I've had an affair with Camilla, there was no point in sort of keeping up any pretense anymore. It just, for various reasons, it felt like that was a step too far, and so they announced their divorce in January of 1995.
Yeah, I did a bit of tracing back, because on their divorce announcement, it said they'd been living apart for 2 years, which takes it back nicely to Tampon Gate. So I imagine they kind of did that kind of Juan Carlos Sofia thing of unofficially splitting. But then, you know, when the future king is on national television, just announcing that, yeah, I have been having an affair with this woman called Camilla and we're in love. And I'm really sorry about that, everyone. At that point, I imagine Andrew's pride. He got to a point where he was like, yeah, this is not working out for me anymore, Camilla. We are no more together. So they officially divorced on the 3rd of March. So like less than 2 months after they announced it. They were in and out.
Very amicable.
So by this point, all the key players in the love hexagon now are single and ready to mingle. And in sort of the autumn of 1995, Charles and Camilla are seen together a bit. So she's goes to Balmoral and Highgrove. And on the 18th of October, they're seen together at a party. And it's not like in public. They're not holding hands at an engagement. But they're being seen together in public really for the first time since 1993. Charles and Diana aren't divorced, but they've been separated for 3 years nearly. Camilla and Andrew are divorced. So it's almost like, I think, I almost feel like in September and October 1995, there was a hope this was going to have a really amicable outcome. where they were just going to get together and everyone would be fine with it. And Diana would go off and marry someone. And Andrew is pretty much already engaged to his mistress. So it's all going to be fine. Nothing bad is going to happen.
Oops.
They cursed it. They did an ass and they cursed their own happiness.
Yeah, we do it all the time. So we know the feeling. Yes. So, of course, we are building up to the infamous interview in November 1995, which Princess Diana did with Martin Bashir for Panorama, the BBC programme. Again, this is a separate conversation, really. So the bulk of the interview, I think, is something that I'll save for the War of the Whales is episode that we inevitably do. But obviously, it was, I think everybody knows the interview. It was much softer than the Morton book, but she essentially went on record to kind of confirm everything. Because again, you have to remember, at this point in time, everybody believed that the Morton book had just been written by Morton with some collaboration from her friends. And Diana said in the Panorama interview that she did not collaborate with Morton, which we know was not true. So, you know, at the time, this was explosive that Diana was going out and actually confirming that this affair had happened, but not just that, that it had devastated her and that it had destroyed her mental health. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not explaining it very well, but it's just, it's one of those things that I think everyone knows it.
Yeah, and it's hard to talk about because so much of it is like it's Diana's story, not Charles and Camilla's. But I think it is really telling and notable at how good and clever I think Diana was at understanding the press and understanding the British public, because in this interview she straight up admitted to affairs and everyone just went, fair enough,
yeah,
why wouldn't you? That sounds really malicious, and I don't mean that way, but I think it shows there's a lot of, I think when people paint the story, they tend to paint Diana as this very innocent, naive person, and she was incredibly clever.
People latched onto that and they could see themselves in it, and the time that their boyfriend had cheated on them, and they connected with that because she always brought it back to like how it had impacted her and how she was the wrong party and how terrible things had been for her. It did build this narrative that, like, you know, beforehand we'd all known that they'd had affairs, we'd all known it had been quite messy, but there wasn't a Saint Diana at the time. Everybody, lots, you know, Diana was beloved, absolutely, but it wasn't the way that it is now, the way that people look back on Diana at the time. And so there were a lot of people who had talked negatively about her and her affairs and things, and a lot of people who assumed that it was kind of like they'd both, it was evenly matched, they both had had affairs and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So when she came out and said all of this, it immediately was like, she is the wrong party and Camilla is uniquely responsible for everything bad that has ever happened to her. You know, not any of the other women that Charles had relationships with, but that it was Camilla. There is a belief that Diana was doing this interview to kind of force the royal family to address her concerns, and because she still wanted to be married to Charles ultimately, but instead it led to the announcement that the couple were going to be getting divorced in December.
Yeah, did not go down well for them.
No.
Yeah, and so they kind of announced their divorce. But again, like with Andrew and Camilla, by July of that year, 1996, the settlements had been agreed, and by August 28th, 1996, the divorce was finalised. And at this point, everyone is single. Charles, Diana and Camilla, officially all single.
Yeah, single, ready to mingle. The relationship with Charles and Camilla, as far as we know, continued. And I think they were still keeping things quite private, but it wasn't a secret. But what I was about to do it again and say what I think is interesting. I keep saying this and I'm really, I don't know what else to say to like link things. We know that kind of, obviously that, you know, Diana had been very angry about things as late as sort of November of 1995 when she did the Panorama interview. We also do know that after the divorce, after things were settled and they were, you know, they were separated and they had their own lives, their relationship actually started to improve. Diana and Charles, I think a lot of the tension between them was the fact that they were sort of in this limbo, and Andrew Morton, who kept up his relationship with Diana, said that there were times where she actually expressed a lot of sympathy for Charles and Camilla, because she said that, you know, she knew that Charles was never going to want to give Camilla up, and that he also might never be able to be with her, and that he might have to give up the throne in order to be with her. And she felt a lot, and she felt genuine sympathy for them at this point in time. So, sort of between 1995 and or 1996 and 1997, things had actually started to improve again.
Yeah, I think I went back and looked at a lot of newspapers headlines and articles from night from kind of since the Panorama interview until sort of 1997, and the kind of the what I call the Diana Cecil was really interesting because post Panorama it is like Diana's an angel, but then very quickly in 1996 with the kind of divorce announcement, it's she really starts to take a sort of downturn in the press's eyes because it looks very manipulative and they're going off about how she's doing things that, you know, she's still doing royal things but not government approved royal things. And then it's what after, like you said, after the divorce is settled, everything starts to kind of mellow out again. And it feels like once they got through that divorce, everyone just went and breathe. And we're going to stop writing weird stories about everyone. We're just going to let everyone get on with their lives. There's less stories about Charles and Camilla that are negative and in general about them. There's less stories about Diana stirring things behind the scenes. And it all just kind of mellowed out at that point.
And I think between sort of 1996 and 1997, you see that they clearly thought, like, well, Camilla's going to stay in Charles's life and Charles is going to be able to introduce her to the public. So they hired my king, Mr. Mark Boland, in I think 1996, who is the PR guru, he's the Machiavelli of PR. He was hired to kind of manage the rehabilitation campaign, to kind of make it so that Charles and Camilla could sort of tentatively step into the public eye. Charles threw a big 50th birthday party for Camilla at Highgrove, which was, well, the press knew about it and they didn't try to hide that. And apparently there was a plan that they were going to kind of soft launch Camilla as Charles's actual partner in November of 1997 at a gala for the Osteoporosis Society, which Camilla had been very heavily involved in because her mother had died of osteoporosis and she's still very heavily involved in it. Things were going really, really well. And then Diana died.
If this was a really clickbaity podcast, we just end it there.
Part two next week. Yes, and again, this is a separate episode, so we are not going to go too far into, or I'm not going to go too far into Diana's death, but we're talking about this from sort of Charles and Camilla's perspective. And it's fair to say that what had been sort of a tone of like, okay, yeah, Camilla's the other woman, but nobody, the hatred had kind of died down quite a little bit with Diana's death and this sort of outpouring of grief from people. Once the Queen kind of gave her speech, and everyone stopped being angry at the Queen quite so much. The anger turned exclusively to Camilla. And Camilla was responsible for everything bad that had happened to Diana. And she was therefore responsible for the divorce and therefore responsible for the fact that Diana had died. And so, there's a lot of stories that go around about what happened to Camilla around this time, some of which we know are not true. But we do know that, the day. The morning after Diana had died, the press swarmed Camilla's home, and she said it's something that she wouldn't have put her worst enemy through. Her children were called murderers in the playground at school. She was allegedly spat on in public. The narrative was Camilla is this evil hussy who destroyed Diana's life by seducing Charles, the weak Charles.
Yeah, it's always the thing that got me because I was just turned one. I was a tiny baby when Diana died. So I didn't really become aware of the world and what was going on until maybe 2001-ish. And I remember at that point, so even then, several years after this, the hatred for Camilla, just in the daily press, like casually, not from like your outliers, but just sort of as normal news stories, they'd be like, yes. And then that evil other woman, Camilla. You know, I always said, like, when Diana died, Saint Diana was born. And Saint Diana's a very different person from Diana. But Saint Diana caused this kind of huge outpouring of hatred and a kind of almost like a sort of desperation for retaliation. But there was no one to, even though there were probably are people to retaliate against, there were people who were actively involved in sort of Diana's death, but that's not a juicy story, whereas the affair woman that, you know, Diana has mentioned on many occasions, where we have a photo of them together, where we know they've been together in public, is such an easy target. And it's one of those things where, like, when Camilla's spoken about press attention, she's like, it wasn't easy. And then that's what she says. Or like, yeah, it wasn't, it's not enjoyable. I don't think it would have been enjoyable either.
Well, I think that's the thing that's interesting.
It's our tally, if I say that.
I know, I'm so annoyed at myself. I think you've touched on something there that, you know, it was obviously an exceptionally difficult time. But she was actually, she's such a strong person, because it really, she does talk about it now in reflection as kind of like, well, yeah, it happened. It wasn't very nice, but you find ways to get over it and to move past it. And it, again, this might be controversial, but it reminds me quite a lot of Kate. Very crucially, they are patient. They know that they can ride out a storm because they're very confident about who they are. They're confident about the choices that they make. They think about them before they make them, so that when they do make them, even if other people hate it, they're confident in their choice. They're confident in their relationships. And so they are comfortable because they know that things will change, or that it doesn't, you know, they're so happy with the person they're with that they're willing to put up with all of that. That seems minor in comparison. So I don't know. They should write self-help books, the two of them.
They really should. I also think they both got a really good understanding of the media and the public in a way, possibly because they're the married in royals. And I say this, married in royals are just more normal than other royals, but than anyone else in the royal family seems to have, because they, I imagine, you know, when this was all going on, people in Camilla's life were going, say something, do something, you know, put your side of the story out there. And she didn't, because I imagine she knew that's going to be an awful idea. And I think for Camilla, she'd been kind of doing the same thing since she married Andrew, pretty much, because they mm-hmm. were both having affairs within a couple of years of marriage. And she was just like, yeah, fair enough. This is my life. I'm going to get on with it. So,
yeah, she's very pragmatic about, like, it's, I know people hate this idea, especially some of our Americans who will listen or think this is really toxic, but it's very British stiff upper lip. Charles and Camilla wouldn't actually appear together in public, sort of together, until February 1999. But the plan to rehabilitate Camilla's image, which was called Operation PB, which had been in place, and, you know, they planned to soft launch her in the November, but Diana died, that began again. At the time, there were really four major barriers that Charles had to kind of confront if he wanted his relationship with Camilla to be accepted. So there was the public, the press, his family, and the church. The press was really the priority, I guess, because they're one of the easiest ones to tackle, but they also are kind of the key to the public's point of view and also to influencing the royal family if the press are all saying a certain thing. And Mark Boland, my hero, identified key tabloids who had a heavy influence over major parts of the British public, in particular the Sun and the News of the World. And he started to weave his magic. So he cultivated relationships with editors like the now infamous Rebecca Brooks, who was the editor of the News of the World and was involved in the phone hacking scandal. And he also had a great asset in Camilla. So throughout this time, even though Camilla and Charles weren't necessarily appearing together in public, he would ensure that Camilla was invited to the same parties as some of the editors of these newspapers or some of the gossip columnists or, you know, the powerful, influential people at these papers. Or he would manipulate the seating arrangements so that somebody would be sitting next to Camilla when they were at an event. And inevitably, what would happen is these members of the press who'd been writing terrible stories about Camilla for a while would start chatting to her. They'd spend maybe half an hour or an hour with her. And by the end of the conversation, they thought she was the greatest thing in the world because she is an incredibly charming person and always has been. And so suddenly the newspaper started to soften their tone a little bit.
The big hurdle, I think, in terms of family, I think there were three big hurdles in terms of family. There was William, there was Harry, and there was the Queen. By this point, William and Harry had never met Camilla. She was just the woman from the newspapers who was having an affair with her dad. But on the 12th of June, Camilla and William met for the first time, apparently accidentally. He just happened to drop by St. James's Palace. She was there with Charles. They had a nice chat. And then they met twice more in quite quick succession after that. Camilla and William met. They seemed to get on fairly well in a kind of, we're going to be family, but we're not besties kind of way. And no one told Harry for a bit.
I think it's a really great example, this whole situation when William met Camilla, of not just the fact that in the background, Charles was sort of trying to address these different barriers that prevented him from being with Camilla in a public way, but also the way that they handled the press situation and my boy Mark again, because details of the meeting were leaked to the press. And it was Camilla's private secretary, Amanda McManus, who took the fall for this, because I think her husband worked for The Times. And apparently she'd gone home and told him. And that was that's how the story had got out. Well, that's the public accounting. And she was fired, but then quite quickly rehired, because apparently Camilla was in tears when she left. She didn't want her to go. A lot of people believe that that Mark orchestrated the leaking of the story. And there was a lot at that time of kind of Mark or somebody from his team leaking something to the press coming to Mark and him going, yes, it's true, but we really don't like that you've published this and you should probably leave it alone. And we hope that you can leave us in privacy now. And it would have been a good story to leak because Diana's beloved son, we don't actually know exactly what happened. It could have just been that Amanda went home and told her husband because she was excited. But what we do know is that the palace officially confirmed the report when it was brought to them by the press that, you know, oh, we've heard Camilla and William have met. And so I think what it shows is the departure is, or the real departure, because we don't know whether these stories were leaked or not, the real departure is that Mark was willing to confirm positive press about Camilla on the record, which beforehand, and possibly today as well, if somebody was in that situation, they would say no comment, because they do to most things.
Yeah, I really like the way he confirmed the story and was like, please, leave them in privacy.
Yeah.
Please stop writing your stories that I just told you about, wink, wink.
Yeah.
I love it. It was great.
We had this good story about William meeting Camilla and that all going very well. But then just a few months later, it was Charles's 50th. Camilla threw a party for Charles's 50th. And the Queen didn't go and none of Charles's siblings went. And then the Queen hosted an official party that was for Charles and Camilla was not invited to that party. So it seemed like, one step forward, two step backs is kind of how I would frame it. And I think you've got, it is possible that they all hated Camilla and thought she was terrible. But it's also possible that this was a year after one of the biggest crises that the royal family have ever seen. Maybe they were still a bit bruised by it and didn't want to necessarily go to a party with Camilla because they didn't want to highlight all of that and see, you know.
Yeah, it was like he got some of the press on side. He got at least one of the children on side.
Yeah.
But the boss was not on side.
The boss is not, no.
The next, well, the kind of first official, non-official appearance of Charles and Camilla together was in January 1999 for Camilla's sister's birthday party. Charles and Camilla were obviously both invited. They arrived separately and they left together right in front of the paparazzi. It was a sensible way to do it because yes, Everyone knew they were both going to be there. It was not an official engagement. It was not a royal event. They also didn't arrive together as well, which I know was probably just sort of not common sense, but it also just looks like they were building up to the big reveal at the end of the night. Like they understand how a good story works and building up to the point where they came out together at the end. It was very clever. I respect it.
It was very conscious of kind of, shall we do it at this event? No, that's not appropriate because that's an engagement. Or should we do it at this event? And no, we shouldn't do it then because we might overshadow. And Mark told the press, if you go to the Ritz, you will probably get a good story. and so about 200 photographers showed up in the end. The press by now were like, amazing. They're working with us. They're giving us exclusives. They're giving us stories. They're cooperating with us. And so they were thrilled.
I mean, I like the pictures because they got in the same car, but they're not holding hands, they're not kissing, they're just walking next to each other and then getting into a car together.
Yeah, but it was so huge. They had to do it eventually. They were going to be seen together eventually. And this kind of robbed any random paparazzo from getting the exclusive and being able to monetize it. They were very in control of the situation.
It was an incredibly staged, natural moment.
Yeah.
Like, they were going to have to leave the Ritz anyway.
Yeah.
But they were like, right, this is the best way for us to get this story out here, get ahead of it. Later on that year, in August of that year, Charles and William and Harry went off to Greece on holiday.
Oh, yeah.
And Camilla joined them. just proves that, A, by this point, Harry has in fact met Camilla. I don't want to call it like the family soft launch, but it's the first time they've been like doing a family activity together.
I was trying to work out like how this all developed, and it seemed like things were going quite well with William and Harry. Whether that was the case privately, we don't know. But the Queen is such an enigma. We know King Constantine, who keeps popping up.
Every time I write his name down this week, I was like, it's him again!
It was his 60th birthday, and we know that this was the first time that the Queen met Camilla in sort of the context of her being Charles's mistress or lover or companion or whatever. I hate the word lover. And again, quite unusually, the palace confirmed that both the Queen and Camilla had been at the party. They didn't say they met up and had a great time and it was great for them to see each other or, you know, anything like that. But even so, normally they wouldn't confirm like the Queen was at this party with a random private citizen. You know, that you could see that and think, well, that's an indication that the Queen was starting to soften on Camilla and that she was starting to sort of welcome her. But then later on in that same year, there was this huge party that was for, I think it was the Queen Mother's 100th, Margaret's 70th, Anne's 50th, Andrew's 40th, and William's 18th.
I mean, if you're going for a big party, that's a lot of birthdays.
It was this legendary party that they had for all of them together, and Camilla was not invited. Jeffrey Epstein was. I know they didn't know this at the time, but just interesting, you know. Although there was like photographs and things of that event, like that wasn't an official, it wasn't like the party at the palace or the concerts that they do for Jubilees and things. It was a private family event and she wasn't invited to that. So it kind of seemed like the Queen was willing to spend time with Camilla if she was there, but she wouldn't want her around.
I like Constantine enough that I'm not going to skip his birthday party if she's also going. But she's not coming to me, I'm organising.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. The Queen is just an enigma of like, I don't know what she was thinking at this point in time.
In 2001, Charles and Camilla both attended an event for the National Osteoporosis Society. This was notable because this was Camilla's thing. And he was there for her because she was the had been patron for 15 years at that point. She was became the president. Charles rocked up with Queen Rania of Jordan. King Constantine was there. Not sure why he keeps appearing. And there's like a receiving line, and Camilla, as the president, is going down the receiving line. And obviously Charles is there, and they have a little, you know, little kiss on the cheek. But that's the first time they've ever kissed in public. I mean, the kiss is very sweet, but I think it was more notable that this is the first time that Charles had publicly been at an event that Camilla had been at, rather than A, it being private, or B, her supporting him.
You know, she got involved with the Osteoporosis Society because of her mother's experience, but it was probably quite conscious to have Charles go to this event to kind of not only have another opportunity to get people used to them being together, but also to kind of spotlight, like, Camilla's not this horrible, evil person. She is capable of doing charity work and being nice.
And then I looked at the press from that evening, and it's all like, public kiss for Charles and Camilla, Prince's first kiss, first kiss on both cheeks. And it's like, it's not their first kiss, guys.
No, I'm pretty sure it's not. We all heard the call.
Yeah, they're a long time. It was like headline news, but not salacious. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, kiss. It was like, Prince has kissed woman on cheek.
Then we move on to 2002, and a lot of things happened in this year which were very important. In April, the Queen Mother died. And the Queen Mother was a very judgmental woman, bless her soul, who did not approve. She loved Charles dearly, but she did not approve of his relationship with Camilla whatsoever. The Queen Mother was a very dominating personality, and even though the Queen was the Queen, she was quite influenced by her mother in a lot of ways. In June of 2002, Camilla was invited to the Queen's Golden Jubilee celebrations.
She was sat, I think, notably in the royal box for the one of the concert, wasn't it?
Yeah.
She was kind of like behind the Queen and Charles, if you angled it right. She was sat right there.
You know, that would suggest the Queen wouldn't invite her to the Golden Jubilee if she hadn't kind of softened her view slightly. In July, the Church of England voted to allow remarriage in the church after divorce in certain conditions. Of course, although Charles and, you know, Camilla didn't end up marrying in the church as such, it showed the change in attitudes and the sort of the fact that the church had acknowledged that divorce sometimes does happen. And then the other thing that happened, and I think this happened towards the end of the year, but I couldn't, the dates that I found contradict each other. A guy called Michael Peet became Charles's private secretary, I think in August, and essentially told Charles, either you marry Camilla or you dump her, because you can't keep doing this thing of her just being your girlfriend. You'll get the future monarch. You can't just have a long-term girlfriend who lives in the palace with you. Like, oh, that's not going to work. You have to pick. And also, our good friend Bruce Shand, Camilla's father, who had once apparently put an announcement in the Times that she was getting married in order to pressure her boyfriend into proposing to her, started to pressure Charles into proposing to Camilla because he wanted to see them walk down the aisle together and him to make an honest woman of Camilla before he died.
I like the concept, the idea that Bruce Shand was like, I have already forced this woman into a marriage by putting something in the Times. I will do it again.
Oh,
And he's the
yeah.
king. He's the king. So come on.
Bring out the shotgun.
So get married.
I love him. He sounds great, doesn't he? And I saw a, even though the public had not necessarily entirely softened, there was, I did see a an article that said that a survey at the time said that 32% of people thought that Charles and Camilla should get married, 29% of people said that they shouldn't, and all the rest, so what's that? 39%? 39% of people didn't know or didn't care. 32% at this point in time, actually, not too bad. There's more people than said that they definitely shouldn't get married.
I know, and it's more of the further proof that most people don't care.
Most people
What's
don't care,
going on?
yeah, which we've said all the time on this podcast.
In 2003, Camilla and Charles move into Clarence House together. Camilla's given an office, and everyone is very, very explicitly saying taxpayer money is not funding her office or decorating her office or anything. She's paying for her own wallpaper. But I mean, she is non-taxpayer funded person living in a taxpayer funded house with an office and security. So we go with it a bit. So it's, I think at this point, it was everyone knew where it was going. We were
Yeah.
heading in a very specific direction.
So I read one article that said that the final tipping point was in 2004. Now, I don't know if this is true, but the wedding of one of the friends of I think it was Evan Cutsem, who was Charles's godson anyway, and friends with the family and friends with William and all of that. But because they were unmarried, the seating plan had them separated, and Camilla had to sit several seats behind Charles. And so apparently, Charles chose in protest to just not go to the wedding because he was so sick. And I think that the argument that these people were putting forward was that, they'd worked really hard to have Camilla be more accepted by the church, by the family, by the public, by the press. And then they just had this reminder from within their own circle that, like, until they actually got married, she was always going to be a second-class citizen compared to Charles, and she was always going to be sat somewhere separate. Apparently, he's a bit of a ditherer, and he doesn't make up his mind about things, and that he'd decide that was what made him decide. Whether we don't know if that, but I can imagine that was a situation that probably did happen quite a lot. Like even at the Golden Jubilee, he didn't get to sit next to her and laugh at the acts and dance and all that sort of stuff because she was several rows behind him.
I like to imagine Bruce Shand was there going, you're separating them at this wedding. And they're like, no, it's Charles and Camilla. I was like, no, separate them.
Like a very sinister Cupid, isn't he?
Yeah. He's going threatening people until he gets whoever he wants
Yeah.
together, together.
Well, he did. Cupid did have an arrow, so.
Yeah, that's it. In February 2005, the 10th of February, they finally announced they were engaged. And they got 25,000 letters, which is a hilariously small number compared to the amount they seem to get on a daily basis today.
Yeah.
And only 908 of them were hate mail that had to go to the police, which I think is a good percentage.
Ratio, yeah.
Although I started reading newspapers columns from the time, but from like small ones, like not like the Daily Mail, from like I don't know, like Chester Gazette, like little ones, and they were talking about all the hate mail that they got for reporting on it and had to send to the police. So I felt like when we say this number of 908, which is still a significant number, that's just the ones sent to either Clarence House, Highgrove, or Camilla's private home. And they were all hate mail about Camilla as well. It was never about Camilla and Charles, it was all Camilla targeted.
That is bad, obviously. Nobody wants to receive 900 bits of mail that are so bad they have to be passed on to the police. However, I'm sure at one point it would have been 10 times that size.
Yeah, I thought 908 was quite small.
Quite small. This is really not that long after Diana died, really. Their wedding took place on the 9th of April, and in the months leading up to it, there were a number of obstacles beyond just people writing hateful messages to them. So they decided that they would have a civil marriage rather than a church marriage, because even though the church had softened their position, they were still a little bit skittish. And there was a lot of debate about whether or not the monarch even could have a civil marriage by law. And there was loads of constitutional experts this must have been the peak of their career, because they were actually being invited to talk on mainstream news about the constitution. Because it was a really big conversation, and there was a lot of debate about whether or not this was even a legal thing that could happen. Obviously they all seem to kind of just go, yeah, it is. We checked with a lawyer and it is, so sucks to be you. And then it all went away.
But that happens a lot when there's anything happens with the royals. They get these people on to be like, can this even happen? And I'm like, yeah, they can.
Yeah, we checked with someone, but we're not going to tell you who. And they said it was fine. They did also have to change the venue. So they originally planned to have their civil marriage at Windsor Castle, but they had to change it to the Guildhall, because the law stated that if you opened a venue up to a civil marriage for one couple, that you had to do it for any couple who wanted to marry there for at least 3 years. And so that would have meant that they would have had to essentially open Windsor Castle up to the public to get married there, which they did not want to do. There was confirmation that the Queen was not going to go to the civil ceremony, which they said was to keep the occasion low key.
It wasn't the most low-key event, I'll be honest.
I don't know. It was all, it, you know, I think that's, I don't believe that. I think that was quite a silly
Yeah.
excuse. I think that, but I also don't believe that it was because the Queen still secretly hated Camilla. I think it was because the Queen is a very religious woman. And so she was sort of softly opposing the concept of civil marriage, because she doesn't agree that civil marriage should exist. I think there was one person who said that it was a condemnation of the ceremony and not the couple.
I mean, I like that. It's probably true.
Because she went to the religious blessing.
Yeah, in a
So,
church.
in a church. So clearly, if she'd hated them, she wouldn't have gone to the religious blessing, would she? The wedding also had to be postponed by 24 hours because, inconveniently, Pope John Paul II died.
I remember, the thing is, I was sitting there thinking, I remember Pope John Paul II dying really, really clearly
Catholic.
because, yeah, a Catholic, and we were watching it on like BBC News at the time, and I wanted to watch like the smoke happening, and I remember her turning over to the BBC News channel to see if the Pope was dead or not, just before casualties started, and he died. So then she wouldn't turn back over for casualty because she wanted to watch the news, and I was like, "He's dead. What are we going to do
What
about
news? Yeah, not going to rise from the dead. Well, maybe. I
it?"
don't
Never know.
know.
Maybe that's where she was going there.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I was like, "But casualty, man, this is the days before we could record things. I'm never going to get the chance to watch this episode." Honestly, I don't remember Charles and Camilla's wedding at all.
Just remember the death of the Pope.
Clearly, that's where my focus was at the time.
But Charles was going to the funeral, so that's, they weren't just really big fans of the Pope. It was because Charles was going to the funeral.
It possibly explained the slightly lower number of royals in
Yes.
attendance because, I mean, no spoilers, so there weren't very many, but most of them had been in Italy the day before for a
Yes,
funeral.
for a funeral. Yes. But the wedding day arrived.
So they had wedding part one, the civil ceremony at Windsor Guildhall. Bruce was there to see the fruits of his labour finally happening. It was, small, sweet. They didn't view that as the real wedding. That was just the boring signing bits of paper things. Like on Don't Tell the Bride, when they'd be like, so we can't actually get married on this island, so this wedding isn't legal. So tomorrow we have to go to a registry office to sign some papers. But this is our wedding. I felt a bit like that.
Definitely.
And then they went off in a little car. They drove around, waving at all the crowds. Everyone else walked into Windsor. And then in St. George's Chapel in Windsor, they had a blessing, which was essentially just a marriage ceremony without the marriage bit. They got the Archbishop of Canterbury in to do it, not the local Dean of Windsor. They're like, sorry, you're being evicted for the day. And then they invited everyone. So obviously the Queen and Philip rocked up to this one, the Gloucesters, the Kent, all the viceroys, some foreign royals. Obviously, my boy, King Constantine of Greece was there to see his celebration. The King of Bahrain, some Saudi royals, Hakon and Meta Marit were there. Constantine and Laurentian from the Netherlands, the Romanian royals, some Yugoslavian royals, and then politicians and religious people, all the boring people we've got to invite. And then I liked at the end of the guest list, it just said, and staff from Clarence House, Highgrove and Raybridge. Because they don't always get invited to things like this.
No, they don't. They often have to stand in a separate room, don't they?
They were in the inner sanctum of the wedding. Yeah. We got staff, got an invite. But yeah, it all went very well. Everyone was happy. It got slightly fewer viewers than Ken and Deirdre's wedding on Coronation Street.
And then in the evening, the Queen gave a speech. Stephen Fry said on QI once that the Queen gave the speech at the wedding standing on a table.
I mean, I hope she was.
Yeah, me too. Used a horse analogy. Of course she did. Overcome all these hurdles and things. And now we're in the winner's enclosure or something like that. The wedding would have been a good opportunity for like Diana's diehard supporters to turn up and like pelt Camilla with rotten tomatoes or something. And nobody did that. So at this point in time, that was quite an achievement.
It was a very good, it was a very good second wedding, but it was a second wedding and they were aware of that. And obviously the first wedding had been the wedding of the 20th century. Beforehand, you had a lot of discussions like, you know, what's Camilla going to wear? Is she going to wear white? She's not she's got two children. Come on, guys. Are they going to hold hands? Are they going to do the kiss on the steps? Despite the fact that they'd had to change the location, the date, who was going of this wedding, it had worked out really, really well.
You know, we're not going to go into the ins and outs of their married life, which we probably should have, given this is the 19th anniversary of their marriage. We probably should have talked about all the things that they did as a married couple instead of talking about all the things that they did before they got married.
We're saving that for the 20th anniversary.
Yes, we'll save that for the 20th. Yes, good idea. I think the most successful royal marriages, when you look at kind of lots of royal families, they have this kind of balance between them where they both kind of offer something to the other that the other doesn't have. In Camilla's case, I think that she's somebody who she's happy to let Charles be the star, but not because she's like submissive and, you know, doesn't, you know, all that kind of stuff, but because she's self-confident enough to allow somebody else to be the center of attention. She doesn't need to be the center of attention herself. She doesn't mind doing her work and, you know, cares a lot about that, but she also knows that her job is to support Charles and that he's going to be the star of the situation, and that doesn't bother her. She's very pragmatic. She's very stable. So when Charles is having one of his mood swings, the Windsor Man mood swings that we all know about, she can calm him down and she can give him perspective on things. She can kind of say, yes, I know that you're really angry at the press, but next week they'll be on to a different story and everything will be fine. Very similar to what I think Kate brings to William, of kind of, she's much more sensible and grounded and down to earth. Camilla had a whole life without being a royal. And so she is very self-sufficient. She doesn't have to be around Charles every second of every day to know that he loves her. She's kept her own house that she bought during her first marriage, and she still goes off there sometimes when she needs her own space. So they're able to spend time together and enjoy their lives together, but they also have their own things going on. And she brings this sort of Philip-esque quality where she's able to lighten the mood in a room, which Charles is not always necessarily as good at. She can kind of be the jokey one and just lift the mood a little bit by being cheerful when he's a bit grumpy. And I think that these are things that over the last 19 years, we've really seen over and over again in their relationship about how much better she makes Charles and how much happier she makes Charles and all of the things that she does that balance him out and that he does that balance her out. And it kind of makes me think of back to the stories that, you know, Mark Boland used to get the press to sit next to Camilla, because if they actually met her and had an interaction with her, inevitably they would end up thinking she was amazing. And I kind of feel like there are still people who hate Camilla, of course, but a lot of people have had 19 years now to get to know her as a public figure, and they've kind of gone, actually, she's quite nice and she's funny and she makes Charles happy and she's quite normal and grounded and she likes the things that normal people like the archers and Strictly Come Dancing and, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, Camilla is one of those intensely charismatic people who genuinely just kind of lights up a room. But she's also, I think, you know, we've seen those people describing her, what she was like, you know, as a child at school. And she's always been, you know, confident, boisterous. And I think she is so confident with who she is and probably always has been. So for her, she's not, you know, I don't think for her she was ever marrying the royal family and you know, dating Charles, the future king. She was dating Charles and she married Charles. And as a result of that, she got a new job out of it, that she's very good at. But there was, I think, you know, by that point, like you said, she was an adult. She had fully grown children. One of her children was engaged to be married himself, you know. She'd been divorced, she'd lost her mother in, you know, a very stressful period of her life. She, you know, probably had to deal with verbal abuse in person. You know, she must have read about things being said about her online. And she was like, you know what? I'm still going to marry Charles because I really like him. And I think that's what's going to make me happy. And for the, you know, last 19 years, they've been very happy.
Yeah, I think for some people, Camilla will never be good enough. And I think affairs are so interesting to me because I've seen so many celebrities who have been alleged to have had affairs, and it's been more controversial than if they'd committed actual crimes. And I've genuinely seen people, I'm sure you've seen it too, equate Camilla and her relationship with Charles as being equally as bad as abusive men who have beaten their partners to death. Which is frankly absurd. You know, I think affairs are a bad thing ultimately because you shouldn't knowingly hurt somebody else, especially if you have children together. But the intensity of feeling about it is really, really strange to me. And it's not just Camilla, it happens to lots of different public figures, but it's seen as like being like the worst crime that you can commit. If the person, if somebody involved who is hurt is beloved, then you are the worst person in the world for being involved in that affair. And, you know, I've talked a little bit about how the intensity of feeling is never extended to Andrew Parker Bowles or to Diana, who was the other woman for lots of marriages, or even to Charles in quite the same way that it has been with Camilla. There is this misogyny, this kind of trope that she is the other woman, and they use that to kind of, she's like the counterbalance to the good, pure Saint Diana. But much of the anti-Camilla narrative came from the book and the Panorama interview that Diana did. And she was in the midst of this sort of feeling of pain and anger and bitterness. And people have latched onto that. But we know that over time, Diana had started to build a friendship with Charles. And there's nothing to say that she felt she's expressed sympathy for them. There's nothing to say that she wouldn't have eventually come to a place where she was fairly amicable with Camilla. Like, I don't think this idea that Camilla was deliberately trying to make Diana's life hell is true. I think it's just that she liked Charles, he liked her, and they indulged that, and perhaps they shouldn't have, but it wasn't to deliberately go out of their way to hurt somebody else. And I think that if, you know, unfortunately, Diana didn't get to live long enough to publicly let go and focus on her legacy and who she was and away from Charles because she died. And so that meant the public have never got to move on and do the same thing. And so if it was me, I would sort of say, you know, instead of making Diana's legacy all about Charles and Camilla, make it about her and what she did, and kind of do what Diana had started to do and kind of let go of things. But ultimately, I think every story has multiple sides, and I don't look to the royal family from my moral compass. It's not the Victorian era. This is a job, and without a shadow of a doubt, Charles is better at the job because he married Camilla. And so I understand why people don't like Camilla to a degree, but I don't think it helps Diana. I don't think it helps Charles. I don't think it helps William. I don't think it helps the monarchy. I don't think it helps anybody. I don't think it helps you to sort of hold on to that. It was a long, you know, they've been married now longer than Charles was married to Diana.
I think a lot of it, particularly, I don't think for the middle-aged women who were there in 1997 when Diana died and have fixated on this, I think for them it is a genuine defense of Diana that she didn't want or need. But that's what it is. Whereas I think for a lot of the kind of the younger people, the people who are anti-royalists, the people who are Kate and William fans, people who are Harry and Meghan fans, it's a kind of, you know, if you remove Diana from the situation, Camilla and Charles essentially had a long friendship that blossomed into romance, and they had to overcome a whole bunch of obstacles to get married and have remained happily married for nearly 2 decades. Like, that's a good romantic story. But it's also not thrilling because they're both well suited for each other. Like, you can see why people say they should have just got married in the first place, because they're a brilliant match for each other. So for a lot of people, it's almost like supporting them is accepting the norm, is accepting the boring stability of the monarchy, and be like, yeah, okay, this makes sense. So I think there's a lot of people use this one relationship, this one marriage, as kind of like a lightning rod for criticism they want to give to other people, but they can't, you know. If, you know, it's not necessarily the cool thing to do to, you know, blame someone for having an affair, but you can blame Charles and Camilla because that's allowed. So people target it all there when, you know, I don't necessarily think they all have any actual emotion towards Charles and Camilla in the first place.
No. And I think it does relate weirdly to some of the health stuff that's been going on, of like, it's not a conspiracy theory, but it's that mindset of assuming that people do things with this like evil plot in mind, and that like Charles and Camilla's marriage was an evil plot to bring down Diana because they were threatened by how great she was. And sometimes people just do bad things and are careless with each other's feelings because they want something that they will make them happy, and so they don't see that it might upset somebody else. And every story has multiple different sides to it, and people interpret it differently depending on how they feel in that moment. I know there have been so many situations where I felt like this person did this to me deliberately, and then an hour later, when I'm feeling a bit more clear-headed, I've gone, maybe they didn't.
That is all we have got for this week's episode. We hope you enjoyed our 19th anniversary Charles and Camilla special. Part two should be out next year, around the same time. We are still collecting questions for our 100th episode anniversary. We've had some lovely questions so far. We've got a great spreadsheet going. Feel free to keep sending them wherever you see fit. And also feel free to rate us 5 stars on all good podcast directories, because it's really nice and makes us happy, and also then makes other people listen, and then more people rate us, and it's all just a really positive cycle of positivity. But until next time, it is goodbye from me
and goodbye from me.